With that, I'd like to introduce Nabil Abraham, Dr. Nabil Abraham, a professor of anthropology at Henry Ford Community College. Nabil is a Palestinian-American who has been involved in Middle East issues for many, many years. He's a contributing editor to the publication Lies of Our Times. And I think most importantly, Nabil is probably one of the people in the area who is most familiar with Professor Chomsky's works. So he's going to give the introduction and a framework for tonight's lecture.
What am I talking into this? No. Which one is listening? Okay. Most people know Noam Chomsky either as the radical critic of U.S. foreign policy or as the world-famous linguist. Few are familiar with both sides of Noam Chomsky's work. Chomsky is the first to deny any direct connection between his scientific work and his political analyses. In fact, the two domains of inquiry are fundamentally different. His scientific work seeks to unravel the mysteries of the human mind, while his political analysis involves little more than describing the workings of power as honestly as possible. To be sure, Chomsky brings to his critique of political affairs the same methodical rigor and precision found in his path-breaking scientific work. Be that as may, there exists a striking paradox in how Chomsky the scholar is received by the scientific community and how Chomsky the citizen and public intellectual is received by the mainstream ideological institutions. In the scientific community, Chomsky's work is followed with great interest not only in linguistics, but also in psychology, philosophy, anthropology, and even in music. For example, Leonard Bernstein once applied Chomsky's notion of transformational permutations to music in a major lecture at Harvard University. In contrast, Chomsky's political writings, some 16 books and numerous articles, are largely ignored, or if reviewed, are summarily dismissed as a work of a crank by the mainstream, of course. His speaking appearances, especially on major college campuses, are often vehemently opposed by faculty members, usually liberals, good liberals, who resort to the crudest forms of slander and outright lies to discredit Chomsky. Enormous pressures are often brought to bear on the sponsoring institutions or departments. Petitions are circulated, strings are pulled to get the speaking invitation withdrawn, and the like. Such outbursts of fanaticism are assured if the topic happens to be Israel and the Palestinians. Often departmental or institutional sponsorship for the talk will be denied on the grounds that Chomsky lacks expertise. That is, he lacks the requisite academic credentials to speak on the Middle East or some other topic that is usually considered the domain of political science, history, or some other ideologically driven discipline. In contrast, Chomsky is often invited to give a graduate colloquium in mathematics or biology or physics at major universities, and no one asks about his credentials. So you see the difference between the real sciences and the ideological disciplines. Clearly, science and ideology have little in common. The former pursues knowledge through rational inquiry and independent confirmation. The latter seeks conformity to dogma, otherwise known as truth with a capital T. It naturally follows that someone like Chomsky, who tirelessly and methodically exposes the real workings of power and privilege, should earn the wrath of the ideological priesthood, whose task it is to silence heretics and skeptics. But Chomsky poses another paradox that we should confront head on. He's a member of the left who does not fit in any standard categories of the left. For many progressives, he remains something of an enigma. This was brought home to me recently by a longtime friend, a Marxist from way back. I shared with him the concluding chapter of Chomsky's latest book, Deterring Democracy. The piece, as some of you will know, titled Force and Opinion, was excerpted in Z Magazine last summer. It is quintessentially Chomsky, a devastating critique of American power throughout history and in the present, resting as usual on a bed of facts drawn from virtually every part of the globe that U.S. power has disrupted. After finishing the piece, my friend indicated he found it stimulating, but added, "I can't figure out where Chomsky's coming from." My friend's remark illustrated the enigma that Chomsky poses for some in the left, long accustomed to thinking in ideologically derived categories: Marxism, Leninism, Stalinism, Trotskyism, Maoism, Castroism, dare I add, Yeltsinism. By now, you may have guessed that Chomsky is no camp follower of any ism or any ideology whatsoever, whatever its suffix. Though, like many of us, he has an affinity to as yet an ill-defined socialism, a libertarian socialism, to be exact, but that tells us little. At a very basic level, Chomsky's analysis of the workings of power stems from sheer, unadulterated moral honesty that is unmatched in contemporary intellectual circles. He confronts the everyday world rationally, looking it squarely in the eye and describing what he sees, brushing aside all the worn-out ideological assumptions, justifications, and rationalizations offered in defense of power and privilege. His affinity is to the truth lying at the core of the fundamental principles of human freedom, dignity, and basic rights. His enterprise requires no theory. In fact, Chomsky argues, convincingly I think, that theory applied to social and political behavior is a misnomer, little more than ideology masquerading as theory. In a century rent with demagogues and dogmas of various stripes, Chomsky offers a way out of the ideological cul-de-sac. Chomsky invites us, by example, to join him in liberating ourselves from the crutch of ideology so as to grasp reality directly. Noam Chomsky.
Latin America has faced more than its share of troubles ever since its liberation from Spanish rule. And one of the most grave of these was in fact emphasized by the liberator, Simon Bolivar, himself. He said that there is at the head of this great continent a very powerful country, very rich, very warlike, and capable of anything. Central America and the Caribbean particularly have suffered from the proximity to what down south is called the Colossus of the North, and their place in the New World Order, the topic of this discussion, will be determined to an overwhelming extent by what happens within our own society, pretty much has been the case in the past. So this kind of discussion is not an academic seminar on, you know, the lives of the Sumerians or even the current tribulations of Sri Lanka. It's a bit more like a discussion, had this been possible, about the fate of Eastern Europe in the Soviet Union, say, 20 years ago. Though, as Latin Americans are quick to remind us, and they are right, that comparison is unfair to the commissars. Now, there is a spectrum of opinion on how we ought to deal with Central America, Latin America generally. You can get a picture at one extreme from this morning's New York Times, which has an interesting memorandum by the next head of the CIA, in which he, from 1984, in which he outlines his proposals as to how we should deal with Nicaragua. And it's worth reading. He says that the basic thesis is, and as he puts it, that we have to rid the continent of this regime, and we should do it any way that's required. covert action. He doesn't think covert terrorism, international terrorism, he doesn't think is going to succeed. So therefore, we ought to go on to economic strangulation. That's advice that was quickly followed with the embargo. He calls for direct bombing, although he suggests that that might be politically unacceptable. But basically, we have to do anything that's required to rid ourselves of this regime. He says if we're still committed to the Monroe Doctrine, which he interprets as a kind of early variant of what used to be the Brezhnev Doctrine, namely that we rule this continent, and if there's something in it that we don't like, we get rid of it by whatever means are required. Well, that's one extreme, and it'll be interesting you hardly have to see, it's so obvious, if a person who is so openly committed to blatant violation of international and domestic law, not secret violation, which everyone's committed to, but open blatant violation, is confirmed for head of the CIA without any a particular nod to it. It'll be interesting to see tomorrow what the reaction is, but I'm not expecting much. Well, that's one extreme. At the opposite extreme of the spectrum, you get the liberal doves, who are usually the most interesting. They define the sort of outer limits of permissible thought, and therefore are revealing. And maybe the best of these in this case is Robert Pastor, who was is a Latin American scholar who was also in the Carter administration, head of the major Latin American advisor on the National Security Council, the sort of Carter administration, I hate to say equivalent because it's not fair, but the pastor, but the person who later, who later became Elliot Abrams a couple of years later, whatever the proper comparison is. Pastor's about as far toward the liberal dovish extreme as you could imagine being in American political or intellectual life and still be kind of on the map. And he has an interesting book about U.S. policy toward Nicaragua, which is worth reading. And in it, he reviews U.S. policy over the years, and he says, the United States did not want to control Nicaragua or other nations in the region, but it also did not want to allow developments to get out of control. It wanted Nicaraguans to act independently, except when doing so would affect U.S. interests adversely. So in other words, they should be completely free to do what we want them to do. But if they use their freedom unwisely, then, of course, well, what can we do? We have to rid the continent of this regime, I suppose. Anyway, those are the two extremes. Again, turning to the hawkish extreme, after having moved, back on this seesaw, you get people like, say, John Foster Dulles, happen to be talking about the Middle East in this quote. These are all internal stuff, but applies generally. And he says we should grant the countries of the Middle East plenty of latitude as long as they don't get out of control. If they get out of control, well, what can we do? That's the spectrum. At one extreme, we allow them latitude until they get out of control, and at the other extreme, we allow them to act independently until they get out of control. And between those two extremes, that's the political spectrum, the intellectual and political spectrum. John Foster Dulles also explained his fears in interesting internal documents that have been declassified, especially about communism. Actually, he's talking about Central America here. He says the problem is, this is a private conversation that he had with his brother, Alan Dulles, who was head of the CIA when Foster was Secretary of State under Eisenhower, says the problem is that the communist ability to get control of mass movements, something we have no capacity to duplicate. The poor people are the ones they appeal to, and they have always wanted to plunder the rich. And somehow we can't appeal to them. We can't figure out why. Eisenhower, who was president at the time, he agreed. He complained that, unlike us, he said, the communists could appeal directly to the masses. And that's kind of like an unfair advantage. That's why they're always getting ahead of us. Now, characterizations like that are pretty common, and they're more or less accurate, but they have one problem, namely they stand the story on its head. It's not that the communists appeal to those who want to plunder the rich. Rather, it's that those who work for the interests of the poor are communists by definition, whether they're following the preferential option for the poor of the Latin American bishops or any other method for plundering the rich. Having done that, they're communists, and then they're out of control, and they're working in a manner adverse to our interests, and then we have a right to rid the continent of them, or in fact rid the world of them, when we became a global power. Well, these are central themes of the old world order. When you talk about the new world order, we kind of presuppose an old world order, and they're going to remain central themes of the new world order. Well, what is the new world order? The phrase was used about a year ago in a quite an important study, a study of, it's worth reading, it's called The Challenge to the South. It's a study of the Non-Governmental South Commission. It's a commission of headed by former President Nyerere of Tanzania, which includes leading economists and ministers of development and such folk from various countries of the South, the Third World. It has quite a conservative cast, actually, if you look at it, like, you know, Minister of Planning from Kuwait and things like that. It's a kind of interesting book. They give a rather accurate description of the North, what's called the North-South conflict. That's the latest euphemism for imperialism. The North-South conflict in recent years, and how the South is being treated and what the problem is, and, you know, so on. Not bad. And they end up the description with a call for a new world order, they call it, that will respond to the South's plea for justice, equity, and democracy in the global society, after just having run through a couple hundred pages showing how it's going exactly in the opposite direction and why. Well, that call for the South's plea for justice, equity, and democracy, that's, from another point of view, the call to plunder the rich, you know, the thing we're always worried about. A couple of months later, that term, the New World Order, was appropriated by George Bush as part of the rhetorical background for his war in the Gulf. So there's two versions of what the New World Order is. Well, the guys with the guns establish the rules, and they also determine the meaning of the rhetoric that's used to disguise them, and therefore it will be George Bush's New World Order and not the New World Order of the South Commission that will prevail, unless, that is, there is a virtual social and cultural revolution among the wealthy and the privileged. And that's for us to determine. Well, what about the question of the place of Central America within this New World Order? Here, I think, to try to think through this, we really want to move to a slightly higher level of abstraction and ask two broader questions within which this one fits. One is the question of how the New World Order differs from the old and what kind of continuities there are with the old. And the second question is the one that the South Commission was in fact confronting. What's the role of North-South conflicts within the world order, new or old, recalling that the phrase North-South conflicts is just a euphemism for what we might call the European conquest of the world, which has been going on for 500 years, and which has in fact been a dominant theme, you could argue the dominant theme of the old world order, with various manifestations as the years and centuries pass. Elsewhere in the world they have different names for this 500-year phenomenon, sometimes called the Vasco da Gama era of world history, or the Columbian era of world history, or the 500-year Reich, to use a phrase that the title of a book on the topic that was just published in Germany, except that the publishers wouldn't allow the title to be used, so they had to change it. But it's devoted largely to what you might expect. Whatever you want to call it, say the 500-year Reich or the European world conquest or whatever, that era was initiated with two colossal episodes of genocide, virtually wiping out the population of the Western Hemisphere and totally decimating Africa through the slave trade and the Atlantic Passage. Next year, as everybody knows, is the 500th anniversary, which we either celebrate or we mourn, depending on which side we place ourselves in this international race class war that's been going on ever since. Using the phrase Europe is, of course, a metaphor. Europe includes, and in fact is led by, the European, former European colonies in the Western Hemisphere, and also Asia. And of course, Europe now includes Japan, which we may regard as honorary Europeans, borrowing now some rhetoric from South Africa, where they were given that designation. So that's what we mean by Europe. And of course, the situation is more complex. It's not just Europe in that sense versus the world. So, for example, the United States, which is the richest and the most powerful state of the north of Europe in this sense, is also moving towards a society with notable third world characteristics. And it's detectable everywhere. I'm sure it isn't Detroit, though I don't know it. If you go to a country like, say, Brazil or Mexico or any standard third world country, African countries or whatever, they're typically very sharply two-tiered societies. There's a sector that can be quite wealthy, maybe super wealthy, and live in a sort of, you know, Western European style. They'd be quite happy in Paris where they, or London, where they spend a lot of their time and a lot of their money, or in New York or whatever. And that's a small sector. Those are the ones who, you know, run the branch offices for the foreign corporations and the local oligarchs and that sort of thing. And then there's a huge mass of the population which lives kind of like Central Africa. Now, I'll say in Brazil, it's maybe 5-10% of the population in the first group, and maybe 75% of the population in the second group, and various modulations in between. The United States is a rich industrial society, so the proportions are different, but the characteristics are similar. And what's more, we're moving towards it. And I think you all know that, and I won't go into it, but these are tendencies which accelerated very sharply during the Reagan-Bush years, although they followed Carter policies, in fact, and were done with bipartisan support and are still going forward, also in England and lesser extent in other countries. So the situation is more complex than just the North-South conflict, but with all the qualifications, it still makes sense to think of the North-South conflict as a central theme of the old world order as it will be in the new world order. So what was the nature of the North-South conflict in the old world order? Well, here there's a lot of information if you want to learn it. And a lot of information from here, because this is a very free society by world standards, and there's a ton of documentary information that's been released, and it tells you exactly the thinking that was going on over the years about how to establish the old world order, the one which essentially was run by the United States since the Second World War. During that period, and in fact going back to the origins of the European conquest of the world, third world, the South, was assigned a certain role, and that role was a service role. Quoting from the wording of George Kennan's policy planning staff in the State Department, which in the late 1940s was very influential in planning and designing the post-war world, the old world order, the South must fulfill its main function as a source of resources and raw materials and cheap labor for the North. The South is supposed to be there to serve us. They provide resources, and as Kennan put it, we have to protect our resources. Happens to be in their countries, but that's geographical accident. They're our resources. We have to protect them. Protect them because they're ours, so we protect them over there. And they've got to provide the resources, the raw materials, the cheap labor, the markets, the investment opportunities nowadays, the opportunities for export of pollution, and so on. That's what they're for. That's the function of the South. Given that, you start looking through the planning documents, say, about Latin America, certain things follow. It follows that the main threat to our interests are what are called nationalistic regimes, and sometimes it's called ultra-nationalism, and that means regimes that are getting out of control. Nationalism or ultra-nationalism or sometimes radical nationalism is defined in, say, National Security Council documents as regimes that are responsive to pressures from the mass of the population for improvement in the low living standards and diversification of production for domestic needs. Now, that is a threat to our interests. That's adverse to our interests in the pastor sense, because our interests, remember, are to keep them in the service role. And if they're responsive to the needs of their own populations and the pressures of their own populations, they're not responsive to our needs, which is the dominant, it's got to be the dominant principle. So then they're out of control, and we got to do something about them. Or, again, quoting from the same secret documents, top secret documents, the problem is that these nationalistic regimes interfere with the creation of a climate conducive to private investment and repatriation of a reasonable return on foreign investment. And that's critical, of course, just as it's, you know, it's harmful to the protection of our resources. So that's unacceptable. These problems, the basic problem, notice, is going to be democracy. Democracy in anything but a truly formal and meaningless sense. Any government that's responsive to the pressures from the masses of the population, and that's going to be more true to the extent that there's more meaningful democracy, popular organization, and so on, is a threat. The threat, the major threat, which has to be stopped. And it therefore follows, you'd expect and you discover, that the U.S. has been extremely hostile to democracy, unless the democracy is just a purely formal matter. So something like, say, Honduras is considered a, you know, like last elections in Honduras. George Bush made some speeches about how it was an inspiring example of democracy in our hemisphere. And it is in the sense of democracy that is meant within American elite circles. There were two candidates. One of them was a wealthy landowner. The other was a wealthy industrialist. They had exactly the same programs. The campaign, not unlike the American campaign at the same time, had no issues with just insults and slander and jokes and so on and so forth. One of them was elected, the other wasn't. The rulers are the military, as they have been always, supported by the United States. In the weeks leading up to the election, there was an increase in state terror and, you know, bodies on the sides of the roads and torture and so on and so forth. During this decade of democracy, which we're so inspired by, the level of poverty, which was already extreme, got worse. Dispossession of land got worse. Ownership by foreign corporations got better. So it's an inspiring example of democracy. That was 1989. That kind of democracy is okay, but the kind of democracy that might lead to governments responsive to the needs of the pressures from the population for improvement in low living standards, that's not okay. And in fact, that's a threat that has to be stopped. If those tendencies get out of control, we've got to move in. And that's explicit. You find it all the time. Just a couple of months ago, there was a seminar held at the Pentagon on U.S.-Mexican relations with academic specialists and all sorts of other people. This one was public, so the records are out. And they described they concluded that U.S. relations with Mexico were unusually favorable, completely untroubled by endemic torture, stealing elections, death squads, you know, harsh repression of labor, grotesque conditions of work in the maquiladora industries. None of that had no problem with that. They were extraordinarily favorable, but there was a problem. The problem was that what they called a democracy opening in Mexico might threaten the current favorable relations for the usual reasons. It might lead to a government more responsive to pressures from the masses of the population to do something about their own problems rather than the problems of American investors. And that's intolerable, that's getting out of control, that's plundering the rich. Things become worse if these nationalistic regimes actually give some indication of some success. That is, if independent development begins to be successful in responding to the needs of the mass of the populations. In that case, a new rhetorical framework is introduced. These countries become viruses that are going to infect the region. they become rotten apples that are going to infect the barrel. I mean, that's the standard rhetoric in public. And we got to really do something about them because it's becoming dangerous. We got to prevent the virus from spreading and infecting the region and getting others to try to plunder the rich as well and to interfere with foreign investment and proper repatriation of profits and our raw materials, et cetera, et cetera. And when that begins to happen, then the retribution is savage. Indochina's a case in point, Guatemala's a case in point, one of the most horrible terror states in the world since they made that mistake back in the early 50s. Nicaragua's a recent case. The popular movements of El Salvador are another case. All of them are viruses. They're trying to plunder the rich. They're giving pressures for meaningful democracy, not the formal meaningless kind, for nationalistic governments in the sense of this great threat that we have to protect ourselves from. And at that point, there is no room for soft-heartedness, especially if the virus threatens to spread. To quote George Kennan again back in the late 40s, there is no room for vague and idealistic slogans about human rights and democratization and raising of the living standards. Rather, we have to use straight power concepts, preferring police states to liberal governments that are too relaxed and indulgent towards communists, where the term communist again means the people who are trying to plunder the rich and who are organizing them. Well, a good deal of modern history falls within the framework that I've just sketched out, which happens to be unusually well documented, and also is much more significantly is illustrated quite consistently in practice. In fact, within this framework, I think we can also place a good part of what's called the East-West conflict, the Cold War. Now, that's usually described in quite different terms, but at least in my view, it's more accurate to describe the East-West conflict as a kind of a special case of the North-South conflict. I think it's always been that, and I think that's now even becoming clearer than it was before. Well, what do I mean by that? This is a contentious view, so, you know, think about it. But it seems to me a reason for believing that, if we look at the Cold War over time and ask how it fit into the old world order, I think, at least to me, it seems that that's exactly what emerges. Recall that before 1917, before the Bolshevik Revolution, what is now the Soviet Union was part of the Third World. It was typical Third World. Two-tiered, you know, extremely impoverished society, very backward, but sectors of wealth, sectors of industrialization, usually foreign-controlled or foreign-owned, you know, tied into the much more restricted transnational corporations of the time, falling even further behind the West at that time. It was basically a colony or a quasi-colony of Western Europe. That was essentially the status of Russia at that time. Now, before 1945, that was also the status of a good part, not all, but a good part of Eastern Europe. Not all, like Czechoslovakia was part of the Industrial West, at least the Czech part. But a large part of, say, Bulgaria was very much like that. So in Bulgaria in, say, 1939, about half the peasants were still using wooden instruments. And that reflects the deeply third world character of much of this part of the world. It was the service area for Western Europe in the usual sense, the usual third world amenities, which I mentioned. Now, these regions separated. Russia in 1917, the parts of Eastern and Central Europe conquered by the Red Army in 1945, they separated, they followed an independent path. They fell under what's called ultranationalism when we talk about the Third World. They pursued a form of independent development interfering with the service function. They were not a service area for Western Europe, a quasi-colonial area. And what's more, it was a virus. They did provide a model that was not without appeal in the Third World. In fact, had considerable appeal, especially in the earlier stages. And if you look at what happened to the Third World during that period, you can understand why. In the West, the standard rhetoric is to compare Western Europe and Eastern Europe, and the pat ourselves on the back on how wonderful we are. But that's a meaningless comparison. I mean, Western Europe and Eastern Europe haven't been alike for, they probably have to go back 1,000 years before they resembled each other. Certainly within historical memory, they've never been alike. A meaningful comparison would be to take Eastern Europe and compare it with the domains of Western capitalism, the South, in other words. So compare, say, Russia with Brazil or Poland with Guatemala or something like that. That's the standard comparison that's made by third world analysts, because they're thinking about their own lives, you know, not trying to beat the drums for the West. And when you make that comparison, things look a little different. Leave it to you to make that comparison. These are tricky issues. But that would be the right comparison to make, one that might be meaningful. And that comparison was not lost on third world intellectuals and economists and others, right, left, or anything else. And there's just no doubt that the Soviet Union was regarded as a kind of a model that offered something that they might think about, compared with their own lot under, you know, capitalism as the service area for state capitalism. So they were a virus, providing a model that others might follow. And the reaction was therefore exactly what it's like when this happens in any third world country. The reasoning is the same, whether it's a speck in the Caribbean or, you know, a huge region like Russia and later its empire. And that's the way it's looked at by mainstream scholarship, by liberal, respected scholarship, if you look closely. So, for example, one of the most important, maybe the most important contemporary diplomatic historian, and rather on the liberal side, is John Lewis Gaddis, who has an important book about the Cold War, which he calls the Long Peace, and he discusses the Western reaction, the Western intervention in Russia in 1917. And he said it was justified. It was a defensive intervention. The West was defending itself. It was a defensive intervention, I'm quoting, in response to the potential intervention of Bolsheviks everywhere, namely the revolution's challenge to the very survival of the capitalist order. So in other words, there was a change in the social order in the Soviet Union, interfering with the service function, and there was a declaration of revolutionary intentions, which amounted to a potential intervention in the West, which would, if it ever took place, challenge the very survival of the capitalist order, and therefore it's justified for us to invade them to prevent that threat to us, its defense. You change your social order, you say you'd like to have changes elsewhere, we have a right to destroy you. That's the logic from the, now I'm not talking about the media, but scholarship, and on the kind of liberal side. And that goes without criticism. You don't find a critique, a very highly praised book, but nobody would criticize this contention. Maybe they don't agree with it, but at least I don't see anyone bringing out what that means. What does it mean if we're allowed to defend ourselves when somebody else changes their social order, because that's a potential challenge to our privilege? In other words, it might mean ultimately they'll plunder the rich. Well, the implications of that are pretty clear, and they're not very different from what I just quoted from Robert Gates's memorandum in 1964. In fact, the reasoning is the same. We cannot tolerate such challenges because we rule the world. The rich deserve their wealth, and if anybody threatens to plunder them anywhere, I won't go. That's getting out of control, and the usual mechanisms have to go into effect. And exactly as in the case of other viruses, it was taken very seriously. The Western intervention in Russia in 1917, for 1918, was no laughing matter. For example, the British, we now know from declassified British records, the British used poison gas. And in fact, the British GHQ, the military command, attributed its early successes on the Northern Front to its use of poison gas. Remember, this is right after World War I, when poison gas was the ultimate atrocity. You know, that was regarded the way, say, you know, nuclear weapons were regarded after Nagasaki. But they freely used poisonous gas against, exactly as they used poisonous gas against what were called uncivilized tribesmen, namely Kurds and Afghans, in the Mesopotamian area, as was recommended by one of the great heroes of the West, Winston Churchill, in 1919, who felt that it was right to use poison gas against uncivilized tribesmen, and he condemned the squeamishness of those who do not want to use the methods of modern science to establish order in these remote regions. Well, that's the way you respond to challenges. And it's right because it's defensive. We're, after all, defending ourselves from a potential challenge, namely a challenge to the survival of the system of privilege and power, the capitalist order, and that we can't allow. The same was true, I mean, it goes right up to the present. The last couple of years, one of the famous government media hoaxes was the revolution without borders declared by the Sandinistas. Well, as I say, that was a media hoax, and it was known very quickly, though it continued to be presented. But there was a truth lying behind the hoax. The declaration of revolutionary intentions, that is, the declaration to establish a society which would be a model for others, and that was the source of the phrase invented by the State Department and then transmitted by the media, speech by Thomas Bourget, in which he said, we can't, other people have to carry out their own revolutions, but we want to be a model that others will follow. That's an unacceptable challenge. That's a potential intervention everywhere, and we have a right to rid the continent of that regime by any method possible. And on that, there's essential unanimity. You don't find much controversy over that within the mainstream, only controversy over how you do it. Do you do it by strangulation? Do you do it by murder, you know, terrorism? Do you do it by invasion? That's the hawk-dove spectrum, but outside that spectrum, there's essentially nothing. This point about the threat of communism, incidentally, is pretty well understood, even in academic circles, if you look carefully. They don't talk about plundering the rich the way the Dulles brothers do, but they put it in bigger words. So, for example, there's a quite important study of the, called the Political Economy of American Foreign Policy back in 1955, big study, National Planning Association and so on, run by a major Harvard political scientist, William Yandel Elliott, and they discuss what they call the threat of communism, and they say that the main threat of communism is the unwillingness or inability of the communist powers to complement the industrial economies of the West. Well, in English, that means they're refusing to play the service function. They're not complementing us. They're not providing what we need, you know, cheap labor, investment opportunities, raw materials, and so on. And that's the problem. That's equivalent to plundering the wealth, and we've got to do something about it. Well, going back to the Cold War, at its core is a classic North-South conflict. A sector of the Third World, and in this case a huge sector, pulled itself out and started going on an independent course, and furthermore was declaring revolutionary intentions, and was regarded outside as a model that's worth looking at. And that's the typical unacceptable effect. It's Grenade, from Grenada to the Soviet Union, you know, opposite extremes of power, the same reasoning applies and the same reaction takes place. Unreflexively, you know, without too much thought. And it's natural, kind of logical in a way. It follows from the basic assumptions, which is why you find it in the planning record, and you find it justified in scholarship, and you find it setting the framework for discussion in the media and the intellectual community and so on. Basically, it doesn't get questioned because it's a deep commitment. It's a commitment to preventing things from getting out of control and making sure that the South, meaning most of the world, performs its service function, just as internal to the domestic societies, most of the population perform their service function for the internal wealthy and the privileged. That's given. You know, you don't discuss those things. That's the international race class war with its domestic analog. Just happens to be, say, in the United States, for example, it's a class war that's fought quite consciously and viciously, but only by one side. You know, you have one group that recognizes themselves as a class and business class, and they do, and they carry out a class war, and they're serious about it. They don't kid around. And the same is true internationally. Well, that threat in the case of the Soviet Union was enhanced by things which you usually don't find in the Third World. Even in the days when Russia was effectively a colony of the West, it did have a powerful military force. That goes way back, you know, goes back into the 19th, 18th century. Very backward society, but powerful from a military point of view. Quite different from, you know, Nicaragua or, you know, Vietnam or Grenada or something like that. And that power was a real problem, particularly in the post-war period, because of its deterrent effect. The Soviet power constrained the use of U.S. power to keep the world under control. there was always a concern that you might run into a confrontation with the Soviet Union, and that's just too dangerous. Now, there's various ways of saying that. One way of saying it is that, say, in the war in Indochina, the U.S. had to fight with one hand tied behind its back. And, you know, it's a big complaint about the war. What that means is that although we could attack South Vietnam with complete impunity, you know, bomb and destroy the dams, chemical warfare, you know, massive B-52 bombings of heavily populated areas, that was all free. Nobody stopped. No one hand there. And in the southern areas of North Vietnam, we could turn the place into a moonscape, which is what happened. And in Laos, we could just carry out huge destruction and devastation, the heaviest bombing in history of a scattered peasant society, soon to be exceeded by the bombing in inner Cambodia, which killed a couple hundred thousand people, apparently, and was just completely unconstrained. All of that was free, no one hand tied behind our backs. But in the northern parts of North Vietnam, we had a problem. If we carried out unconstrained military action, we might run into the Chinese or the Russians, and it's like an axiom of statesmanship that you don't fight anybody who can shoot back. That is really stupid. What you do is attack people who... it's understood in the criterion for being a statesman that you never attack anyone who might shoot back. That's, like I say, dumb. And that's what's called deterrence, except we use the term only for half of the story, or part of the story, in fact, the smaller part, namely our deterrence of an alleged Soviet attempt to conquer the world, which incidentally American planners never believed in. So, for example, President Eisenhower was strongly in favor of NATO, but because, as he said, NATO will give the Europeans strength and courage to respond to the political challenge of the communists, not their conquest of the West, but their political challenge. But that's what's called deterrence theory, and it's real, except they work the other way. The Russians were, you know, rotten enough in their own domains, but their domains were limited. And there they acted with complete brutality. We acted essentially the same way everywhere because we're a global power. And we were deterred. We had to fight with our hands behind our back, one hand behind our back, because at some points there might have been a threat that we would run into a big power, and that would be too dangerous. So that was a deterrent effect which made the Soviet challenge even more serious than the normal Third World challenge, quite apart from its great scale, which was, of course, itself important. You know, scale of Eastern Europe is way beyond Nicaragua, obviously. Another crime of the Russians was that they gave aid and assistance to targets of U.S. attack. So, for example, for their own reasons, not out of the softness of their heart, but for great power reasons, if the U.S. was targeting somebody from destruction, they could sometimes turn to the Russians for support, and they'd give them some help. And that combined with a deterrent effect. And that's another crime which made, you know, which amplified the normal North-South conflict into even bigger dimensions. So it was, the East-West conflict was like a, in my view, a kind of a big version of the North-South conflict. Different because of scale, but essentially the same in terms of reasoning. Now, as the Soviet system collapsed, you see all this coming out. So by the late 1980s, American strategic analysts and others were explaining, incidentally quite publicly, that one of the major benefits of the Soviet collapse is that it frees the United States to use military power without constraint. For example, in December 1988, in an op-ed summarizing, you know, what happened in that year, kind of thoughtful commentary on 1988, there was an op-ed by Dmitry Symes, who's a senior associate of the Carnegie Institution for International Peace, has about the meaning you'd expect, and he described the various, you know, he was talking about he's a Soviet expert, and he's describing, you know, dangers and advantages, and the major advantage to us, he said, is that this frees the United States to use its military force without concern that there might be a problem of conflict with the Russians. That's good. We can now use military force freely. When the U.S. invaded Panama, Elliot Abrams, who had been the Latin American advisor for the Reagan administration, pointed out that this was the first time the United States was able to carry out a third world intervention, meaning invasion of some country, without any concern that there would be a Soviet reaction anywhere. So we were much freer to use force than before. During the Gulf War, this was standard. lots of people pointed out what was in fact obvious, that now the United States was free to use force. We didn't have to fight with one hand tied behind our back. It wasn't like the northern part of North Vietnam. Now we could do anything we wanted because there was no deterrent. You can find that today, I think, or maybe yesterday in the New York Times, where there's a discussion of Bush sending warplanes to Iraq, and they quote some. They say the Democrats think this is great, up to Saudi Arabia, say the Democrats don't have any objection, they think it's fine, and they quote a Democratic policy advisor who says it's fine, there's no cost involved, there's no concern that there might be superpower confrontation. That's the only possible cost. I mean, the only possible cost would be a cost to us. That's the meaning of cost. And now there's no such problem, because nobody's going to respond. There's no deterrent any longer. The United States is no longer deterred. It is now capable of using force wherever it wants. 10 years ago, the British and the Americans couldn't send half-million troops to the desert because it was just too dangerous. There was a big force out there. We might get into trouble with them. They could shoot back, a lot of problems. Now there's no problem. We can do anything we like. The other aspect of the deterrence has to do with the aid to targets of U.S. attack, and that problem is also disappearing. And again, there's much crowing about that. Throughout the late 80s, there were constant discussions of what's called Gorbachev's new thinking. And, you can read the editorials in the Washington Post and so on, and they say, well, we don't know if he's really serious about this. But the test to see whether Gorbachev is really serious about his new thinking will be if he stops giving aid to the people we're trying to overthrow and destroy. Then use those words, but that's what it amounts to. The test of Gorbachev's new thinking will be, does he withdraw assistance from the Sandinistas, that regime that we're trying to rid the continent of, to return it to the Central American mode, as the Washington Post put it, and get it to observe regional standards, quote the doves like Tom Wicker, meaning be a nice place like El Salvador and Guatemala and so on. If Gorbachev stopped, if the Russians really let us do this freely without getting in our way by giving them aid and assistance, then we'll know that the new thinking is serious. In other words, they got to leave the third world free subject to our whims, and in that case, we'll know that they're serious, the new thinking is real, and maybe we'll pay some attention to them. Meanwhile, the absence of the deterrent means we can use force freely as we wish. Now, the Soviet new thinking, incidentally, is not to be matched by any new thinking on our side. We continue with old thinking. It's just that we're now freer to do it than before, because the deterrent is gone, this dangerous tendency of aid to our victims is gone, and the spreading virus effect is gone, so we're just freer than before to carry out the old thinking. And the old thinking is, in fact, quite old, and it's worth bearing in mind that its themes are very resilient. Coming back to Central America and the Caribbean, let's take the next obvious victim, Cuba. The United States had a long relationship with Cuba, and it basically has the same theme all the way through, so it's worth thinking of. Thomas Jefferson thought we ought to annex Cuba. Couldn't do it at that time. The British were then a deterrent. They were the problem. This British fleet was too big, and we couldn't get there without getting shot at and so on. So we couldn't carry out the annexation of Cuba, although it was the natural thing to do. John Quincy Adams argued that we ought to wait. We can't do it right now, but we ought to wait until the fruit is ripe. And that was the common idiom that was used for a long time. We wait until the fruit is ripe, and came with Adams, it'll fall into our hands by laws of political gravity. Now, in order to make sure that that happens, it's necessary to prevent the liberation of Cuba. So the U.S. was strongly opposed to the liberation of Cuba. This is the kind of comment that elicited the statement by Simon Bolivar that I mentioned earlier. The U.S. was strongly opposed to the liberation of Cuba. It was in favor of maintaining Spanish rule because that would eliminate the danger that they might go their own way, and that way we could wait till the laws of political gravitation work, the ripe fruit falls into our hands. Another problem was that the liberation movement in Cuba had dangerous democratic tendencies. In particular, it was calling for the abolition of slavery and for equal rights for all, for blacks, and that was unacceptable. That's that, virus effect again. And so plainly the liberation of Cuba was not a good idea. Without going through the whole history, I mean, sure you know it, by the end of the century, the U.S. just conquered, finally the laws of political gravitation worked, and the U.S. conquered Cuba in the guise of liberation and turned it into what amounted to a colony, and that's the way it stayed until 1959, at the time of the Castro takeover. Well, that elicited almost immediate hostility. It didn't take very long. CIA actions to destabilize Cuba began within a few months. The basic policy was explained in a secret planning document, now declassified, of March 1960. So that's virtually right away. That's still the Eisenhower administration. And it called for replacement of the Castro regime with one more devoted to the true interests of the Cuban people, which, of course, we determined for them, and more acceptable to the U.S. Okay, so that's, we got to replace, we got to rid the continent of this regime, standard thing, replace them with one more devoted to the true interests of the Cuban people and more acceptable to the U.S., and bear in mind that this was at the time when CIA studies and others were talking about the tremendous popularity of the regime and so on, its growing popularity, because of its nationalist character and so on, but that didn't matter. Those guys don't understand their true interests. We understand them. And furthermore, the document continues, this must be done in such a manner as to avoid any appearance of U.S. intervention. Now, why is that important? Well, because we got these, you know, these kind of crazy people in Latin America to worry about, and they don't like the appearance of U.S. intervention, so we have to make it seem as if it's just the laws of political gravitation. Okay, that's the policy from early 1960, and the policy that has been followed since. There were problems. One problem was the Soviet aggression. Like, they opposed a deterrent to our direct attack, and they also were giving them aid in the days before New Thinking, and that prevented the ripe fruit from falling into our hands. But now, that's gone. We got New Thinking. The Soviet Union is refusing to give any sustenance to the targets of our attack, and there's no longer any deterrent. So now there's a good deal of crowing about how finally we can rid the continent of this regime and satisfy the true interests of the Cuban people and our own. But of course, remember, this has to be done, quoting again the March 1960 document, in such a manner as to avoid any appearance of U.S. intervention. So that means that if the United States is going to achieve its long-standing goals which go back to Thomas Jefferson, then the media and the ideological institutions have to play their part. And that part requires a few conditions, and you'll notice that they are being met with great consistency. It's necessary, crucially, to suppress the record of aggression, the vast campaigns of terror. I mean, Cuba, since Kennedy administration, has been subjected to more international terrorism than probably the whole world combined. Economic strangulation, cultural quarantine, intimidation of anybody who might try to disrupt the ban, and in fact all the other devices that are available to a superpower who's dedicated to the true interests of the Cuban people. All of this has to be suppressed. Cuba's plight, which is real enough, has to be attributed solely to the demon Castro, or maybe the failed ideology of socialism. They alone, I'm now quoting from the New York Times, they bear full responsibility for the poverty, isolation, and humbling dependence on the Soviet Union. Solely their fault, New York Times editorial, September 8th. The Cuban dictator has painted himself into his own corner, no help from us, by doctrinal necessity, and we have to make it clear that it's all his own doing. That's the way we satisfy the policy goal of avoiding any appearance of U.S. intervention. Castro's reign deserves to end in homegrown failure, not martyrdom. Notice, by taking that position, the New York Times lines up on the devilish side of the spectrum. It's opposed to the tough guys who say we should just invade and overthrow them. Rather, we should continue to ensure that to rid this hemisphere of the regime, but without appearance of U.S. intervention. In other words, by economic strangulation, by intimidation of anybody wants to bar the ban, by terrorism if necessary, but in such a way as to make it look like it's all their own fault. And in order to do that, we suppress the entire record of what's been happening, as we've been doing quite successfully for about 30 years. Well, that's standard, predictable, tells you what's going to happen next. And in fact, that's the record that is to be played until the ripe fruit drops in our laps, or maybe is pulled from the tree. These are all themes of the old world order, which just continue. Now you can apply them more freely than before. The end of the Cold War does lead to changes, no doubt. So this big area of the Third World that had separated itself in 1917 and more extensively in 1945, that's now moving back in. So the West is imposing the standard principles that we impose on the Third World, what's called liberalization, structural adjustment, free markets, all that kind of stuff. Notice that no industrial society ever accepts that for itself, for very simple reasons. There's no way to achieve industrial economic development if you follow those rules. In fact, if you look at the history of economic development from England right through to South Korea, you find that, as far as I know, 100% of the time, it's been achieved by violating those rules. So the development of England, the first modern industrial society, really began with the Navigation Act of 1651, which closed off the British Empire, made it a controlled area, subjected to British domination. You kick out the Dutch fleet and the Spanish and that sort of thing, and carry out capital accumulation through the slave trade and the robbery of the colonies, later the rape of India. All of that state activity finally leads to the point where you have takeoff, and then you can impose free trade. Free trade is a doctrine of those who know they're going to win. If you know you're going to win in the competition, you're in favor of free trade because you're going to win. On the other hand, if you have to develop your own economic system, you're not in favor of it. And in fact, every later developing country followed the same prescription. Take, say, the United States. The United States did not follow the principles we're imposing on the Third World, never has. If we had done so, we'd probably still be pursuing our comparative advantage of exporting furs to England and importing steel from them. We wanted a steel industry, an auto industry, and that sort of thing, so we applied huge protective tariffs, closed off the system so we could deal with the much cheaper and more efficient British industry and prevent them from stopping our own development. This goes right up to the present. The Reagan administration is one of the most protectionist administrations in American history. It virtually doubled the percentage of imports subject to duties of one kind or another. It went from 12% to 23%. The Pentagon itself is a massive intervention in the economy, state intervention in the economy. The Pentagon is the system, from an economic point of view, the Pentagon is just the system by which the state ensures the viability of high technology industry. It's the system by which the state forces the taxpayer to pay the costs of high-tech industry and research and development, in other words, and to provide a state-guaranteed market to produce unsellable waste. That's massive state intervention. And in fact, every sector of the American economy that functions internationally is protected in the same way. So take, say, agriculture, which doesn't mean peasant farmers. It means capital-intensive agribusiness. That functions through massive subsidy, meaning taxpayer subsidy, plus forcing the products onto the Third World, what's called aid, intervention, and so on and so forth, all state intervention to ensure that the thing keeps going. Same with pharmaceuticals, same with virtually anything. And that's been the story from, from England to South Korea. Take a look at the history of development, that's the way it works. Countries that pursue that path have some chance, maybe, of development. Others don't. Structural adjustment, free markets, that's a prescription for robbery by the rich. We don't follow it. Like Germany, for example, their subsidies to industry are estimated by the OECD, the Economic Commission of the Advanced Countries, as amounting to about a 30% tariff. We'll never permit any third world country to do anything like that because they have a service function. They're supposed to serve the rich, not develop. So now that's all being imposed on the former Soviet domains, which means that large parts of them are very likely to undergo a process of kind of Latin Americanization. probably move towards something like Brazil or Mexico, you know, a lot of historical differences and so on, and there'll be diversity within the region, like Czechoslovakia probably become part of the industrial West again. But for much of it, the prospects are something like Latin Americanization, and you can see it when you look at, say, Poland or and so on. Now, remember that in a Latin American style or, you know, African style third world country, there is a rich sector, and there'll be one there too. Somebody's going to be running the local franchises of the transnational corporations or running the McDonald franchise or whatever. And it's very likely that that'll be the old nomenclatura, you know, the old Communist Party. Those are the guys who know the ropes, you know, and those are the guys who the Western countries want to deal with because they sort of know their way around and they have the contacts and so on. And you can see that developing too. You take a look at Eastern Europe, you see that, not universally, but you know, to a large extent, those are the people who are still in the managerial role, but now subordinating themselves to the interests of the West instead of pursuing some independent path, and therefore quite acceptable, maybe even if they're the same faces. So one part of the New World Order is very likely to be a reversion of substantial parts of the former Soviet tyranny to the something like the traditional role of a service area for the West. Now, that's not a real gain for the United States. In fact, the U.S. is kind of ambivalent about all of that. And the reason is very simple. We're not ahead in that competition. It's Europe that's ahead in that competition. Europe means German-led continental Europe. They're way ahead of us in that. The U.S. economy suffered a severe blow under the Reagan-Bush administrations. It's capital short. It's deeply indebted. Germany and Europe, on the other hand, have investment capital. Furthermore, they're close by, and these are traditional relations and so on and so forth. So they're way ahead of us in the game of robbing the former Soviet domains. Furthermore, the Japanese are just sitting there on the opposite side. Again, capital rich, you know, got their eyes in Siberia. They're waiting until it becomes profitable, but sooner or later they'll move if it does. And the U.S. is still kind of out of that game. So that's not good. But that's, and in fact, the U.S. is responding to that as best it can by trying to construct, by strengthening the U.S. control over the Western Hemisphere. That's called the Free Trade Agreement. First, with Canada. Canada has a role in this system. Canada is supposed to provide resources, which it has aplenty, and skilled labor. But, of course, it has to dismantle all the disruptions, like the welfare system and unions, and you know all of this stuff that interferes with devices for plundering the rich. And that's happening in the 2 years of free trade. Canada, according to the Canadian labor unions, has lost about 250,000 jobs. Lots of takeover, big capital flight. Mexico is supposed to come in next. Mexico offers many advantages. The maquiladora industries in northern Mexico are very attractive. That's the reason for that euphoria that I mentioned before in the Planning Commission. Very cheap labor, some of the cheapest in the world, essentially no environmental protection, so you can pollute at will, large profits, and so on and so forth, try to extend it to the Caribbean basin, as much of Latin America as viable. That's another part of the world order, as the U.S. tries to shore up its own domains as, you know, the other powers stake their positions. Well, that's one part of the growing New World Order. Another part is at the kind of rhetorical level. It's necessary to find new pretexts for intervention. From 1917 until the mid-80s, there was a reflexive justification for intervention. We were doing it in defense against the Russians. Didn't matter how absurd the pretext was, you could always pull it out. And, you know, it had a kind of a, the purpose of these pretexts is to frighten the domestic population, so they'll go along with policies they don't approve of. And that was always frightening. Russians were brutal and vicious and had missiles and power, so, you know, maybe they're really coming. So therefore we should, you know, overthrow the government of Guatemala or whatever the task at hand was. Now, Woodrow Wilson needed different pretexts in 1916 when he sent the Marines to invade the Dominican Republic and Haiti with consequences that they still haven't escaped from. And George Bush needed new pretexts when he invaded Panama in 1989. That reflexive justification was gone. And that's a problem. In fact, this problem of the vanishing pretext was recognized right through the 80s. And that led to efforts to compensate for it. You know, international terrorists and Hispanic narco traffickers and crazed Arabs and, you know, Libyan madmen and so on and so forth. But none of them really live up to the image of the Soviet Union, so that's an increasing problem. Third feature of the New World Order, as I mentioned, is that there's no deterrent and no aid to the victims of U.S. attack. Now, the Third World is quite aware of this. There's a lot of concern throughout the Third World about this issue, very much enhanced by the Gulf War. It's hard to get a sample of Third World opinion in the United States because almost never, never discussed. But if you look, I've tried, you find that I think there's a good deal of consistency. The general mood is expressed rather well by the Cardinal of San Paolo, Cardinal Arnes of San Paolo, who wrote recently that the mood throughout the Third World, he said, is one of hatred and fear. When will they invade us, and under what pretext? And that looks pretty accurate. You find responses like that, especially the Gulf War, throughout Latin America, Africa, India, other parts of the Third World, and it's quite understandable. They can understand what's happening before their eyes, that this lawless, violent power is now free to do what it wants, at least militarily. Well, these are all basic elements of the New World Order. Now, let me make mention that this Soviet collapse, which is, you know, that's just part of a much more general change that took crisis in the 80s. Around 1980, there was a major global economic crisis. Germany and Japan sort of pulled out of it, though they never resumed earlier growth rates. The U.S. partially pulled out of Germany, I mean German-led Europe. The U.S. partially pulled out, but only in a sort of a fake way, with enormous indebtedness, you know, sucking in capital from the outside, sharp deterioration of infrastructure, you know, this move towards a third world society with big costs to be paid. As far as the third world is concerned, the domains of Western capitalism, they were just devastated. They were completely devastated by the crisis. The 1980s were a huge catastrophe of capitalism, tremendous setback to virtually all the domains of Western capitalism, except for the sectors right on top, like Germany and Japan, and to a limited extent the United States, at least the richer parts of it. Now, the Soviet Union was hit by that as well, less severely than the Third World, but badly, and that combined with the growing stagnation, the protest against the tyrannical system, and so on, and that led to the deterioration of the Soviet system. Well, parts of the Third World escaped this. The so-called newly industrializing countries of East Asia, like South Korea and Taiwan. They were hit by the economic crisis, but unlike the rest of the Third World, they escaped it. They're quite different from Latin America. And it's interesting to look at the differences. You learn something about what's going on. Up until about 1980, Latin America and these East Asian countries were developing more or less in parallel. From about 1980, they diverged very sharply. Latin America went way downhill. Central America, all of Latin America was hit very hard. South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, they kind of pulled out. I mean, problems, but they pulled out. What was the difference? Well, one of them, a lot of differences, but one of the major differences, if you look at the crisis of Latin America, a large part of it reflects the openness of Latin America to international capital markets. They suffer from the free market. Which means that if you're a wealthy person in Latin America and U.S. interest rates go up, you'll send your capital out to the United States to make money. That's what capital's for. And there was a huge capital flight from Latin America. In fact, throughout the Third World, there's been an enormous drain of capital to the north. You know, big flow of capital from the south to the north, which kept the U.S. economy floating, but also very seriously harmed the Third World. In fact, a large part of the Latin American debt is accounted for just by the flow of by the fact that they can't control their own wealthy. They send their wealth to the United States and, you know, London stock market and so on. They don't keep it there. Now, that didn't happen in South Korea, for example, for a very simple reason. In South Korea, the state is not only powerful enough to discipline labor, which is the usual situation, but it's also powerful enough to discipline capital. So there's no problem of capital flight in South Korea because you can get the death penalty for it. In short, South Korea insulated itself from international markets by the use of fascist-style methods, and therefore it didn't suffer the way the more open societies did, the ones that were more subject to liberal free market problems, and therefore they were able somehow to sustain this. Actually, there's much more to it than that, but that's a good part of the story, and it's worth remembering, and let me stress again that the developed economies have never been willing to accept these rules for themselves in the past. That's why they're successful economies, and they certainly don't now, including crucially the United States. Another element of the New World Order, and a major one, I'll end with that, is the changes within the North. That's a central part of the New World Order. And those changes aren't the last couple of years. They go back about 20 years, and the Vietnam War was a major factor. By about 1970, the U.S. had lost its domination of the international economic system. And that was symbolized in 1971 when Richard Nixon essentially destroyed the international economic system that had been established after World War II. The so-called Bretton Woods system was dismantled. That was a reflection of the fact that the U.S. couldn't dominate it any longer. And from that point on, the rich parts of the world have been moving towards what in those days was called trilateralism. Now it's sometimes called tripolar economy, various terms that mean that there's three major sectors of power, of economic power, the German-based European sector, the Japan-based Asian sector, and the U.S.-based regional sector where we're trying to incorporate Canada and Mexico and so on. Well, that three-block system is, first of all, it's again, as always, more complex and more complex than it used to be, because the notion of a nation doesn't have the meaning that it once had. There's a lot of internationalization of capital. Like, it's hard to decide whether a corporation is, let's say you have a corporation with an executive office in New York and another one in Zurich and, you know, assembly plants in, wherever, Papua New Guinea or something like that. Where is it? Well, it isn't anywhere particularly. It's a transnational corporation, and that interpenetration has developed to such a point that the conflict among the three blocks doesn't have the same kind of status that it did, say, 50 years ago. It's real, but not the kind of status it had before. Rather, there's a kind of a combined interest of transnational capital against the poor everywhere, in their own domestic societies, in the third world, and so on. So it's an international class war with strong racial aspects, too. That's the developing New World Order. The various players have their own interests. Germany and Japan don't necessarily have the interests of the United States. For the South and for the growing third world at home, the prospects are not at all auspicious unless, again, there are major social changes and a kind of cultural awakening at home, here, other rich countries. Now, to try to carry that out, that's not an easy task, but it never has been an easy task, and it's a task that has often been confronted under conditions that few of us can even dream about, and in fact is being confronted under horrifying conditions right now in Central America, for example, in El Salvador, and not only there. And those, I think, are facts that we should bear in the forefront, or keep in the forefront of our attention as we think about these problems. Thanks.
We're going to have questions and answers coming up after, not a break, so don't go away. We heard a question and answer period at Henry Ford Community College earlier, and it was very good, lively, so I would suggest you stick around. As Professor Chomsky just mentioned, there are people trying to make changes under incredibly horrible conditions, and probably everyone, just about everyone in this room, is familiar with the conditions in El Salvador. Right now, CASC is going to ask you to help keep the issue alive in this country, even though the media has declared it a non-issue. We know the government, our government, is supporting terror in Central America, and groups like CASC and groups that some of you belong to are trying very, very hard under difficult conditions here to keep that alive. So we're going to ask you to help us tonight by doing three things, and I'm going to ask about the first two. The first one, in your program, there is a kind of a golden card here, and what we'd like to do,
I'll repeat if, because I can hear. The point that he made is a very important one. He pointed out, which is certainly accurate, that of the trilateral powers, you know, the three powers, and remember, despite all the problems, the United States is still the biggest economy and the richest power, though relatively declining. Given that there's three major economic powers, one only major military power, that one declining economically, no longer with the economic base to pay for global enforcement, is there a new status for the U.S. in this system? That's a question which is quite accurate, and you know, usually the business press is a couple of jumps ahead of us, and that's a topic that has been raised and discussed repeatedly in the international business press over some time now, and they drew the natural conclusion. I mean, the obvious conclusion is that the United States should become what is sometimes called a mercenary state. We should become Hessians. We should use our comparative advantage. Leading American financial investment analyst, David Hale, writing in the London Financial Times, which is, you know, the kind of British Wall Street Journal, pointed out months ago that the U.S. should become a mercenary state, his phrase, even more than in the past. When Lawrence Eagleburger, Deputy Secretary of State, testified before Congress on the New World Order, he emphasized exactly this point, and he said the New World Order will have to have a new invention in the art of diplomacy, namely exactly that. We'll carry out the enforcer role, others will pay us for it. James Webb, former Reagan Secretary of the Navy in the Wall Street Journal, discussed the same point last January. He happened to be critical of it. You know, he didn't like it. He didn't like the fact that the Bush administration was, as he put it, relentlessly maneuvering the country into an unnecessary war. But he described the same phenomena. He said the Bush administration is quite happy to turn the United States into Hessians. It was his term. Meaning, we do the killing, other guys pay us for it. And that's pretty, the clearest exposition of this that I've seen is in the financial pages of the Chicago Tribune, major conservative business newspaper, where their financial editor's been writing about it for some time and pretty clearly. He says we should use he says we have a virtual monopoly of the security market. That means we got the guns, you know. And we should use this to help maintain our control over the world economy. Now, the way we do it is, as he puts it, by pounding our fists on the tables in Japan and Germany. So making sure that they buy our exports and prop up our economy and so on. But also, we get them to pay. He suggests that we run a global protection racket. That's what he says. You know, we should sell protection to other powers. They should pay us a war premium. He suggests the model of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. They pay us a war premium. We then sell them protection. Now, this is Chicago Tribune. You know, everybody knows what that means. The local mafia don sells protection to the storekeepers on the block, you know. And if somebody's in their way, you call to the guy you paid your war premium to, and he goes out and breaks their kneecaps or leaves them in a ditch or whatever the appropriate reaction is. But you got to pay up, otherwise you suffer the same thing. And that's what we ought to do. Now, the assumption behind this is there's a shared interest on the part of the rich in the world. That shared interest is that the third world play a service role. We're in a position to enforce that shared interest. So we'll sell protection to others, and we will then carry out the enforcer role, and they'll pay for it. And what's more, they'll pay for it even if they don't like it. And that's pretty much what all of this was played out in the last couple of months. This is not hypothetical. This has all been done in the last year. You know, we've been watching this happen before our eyes. The war in the Gulf was a unilateral U.S. war, and the British came along, but they regard themselves as our puppy dog, basically. So the British and its, you know, the U.S. and its British lieutenant, as it's described in internal documents, the U.S. and its British lieutenant fought a unilateral war. They're the traditional enforcer powers. You know, they're the ones that have the experience in beating up people in the third world and so on. They're also declining economies, British, even more than us. So they fought the war. Nobody else wanted it. You go back to August and September, you'll recall that the Japanese didn't want it, the Europeans didn't want it, Germany refused to pay anything at first. They said, look, this is bilateral arrangement between the United States and Saudi Arabia, we have nothing to do with it. The European community backed them up. They made various speeches about taxation without representation. Gradually, the U.S. continually turned the screws, and finally they came up with it. And the net result probably is the U.S. made money on the war. It's hard to know just how to tot it up, but it looks as if the people who were supposed to subsidize our enforcement did it enough so that there was probably even a net profit. You take a look at the financial pages these days, that you'll notice discussion about how the balance of payments is bad this month. But that's because it was artificially good the last couple of months. It was artificially good because the countries where we've been pounding on the table were paying up for our act in carrying out the enforcer role. Well, that's a natural result. Now, of course, there's other aspects to this. One of the major sources of capital, three major sources of capital in the world. There's Japan and German-based Europe, and we're going to put the screws on them, and they'll pay us to, protect them from, run the protection racket for them. That's the idea. But there's a third one, and that's Gulf oil production. Now, all the talk about fighting the war for oil was sort of right, but only partially right. It was really fighting the war for the profits from oil, which is something quite different. And has policy, it's a difference that has policy consequences. So it was argued by plenty of people in the peace movement that what we ought to be doing is moving to alternative sources of energy so we don't depend on Gulf oil. Well, we ought to be moving to alternative sources of energy for other reasons, but not for that reason. Because if we had zero dependence on Gulf oil, if we were 100% on solar, let's say, we would have followed exactly the same policies as we did when we didn't depend on Gulf oil at all. And the reason is, Gulf oil production is enormously profitable, and that flow of capital is extremely important to prop up the declining economies of the traditional imperial powers, the enforcer states, Britain and the United States. That's documented in the internal record, incidentally, and it's surely operative now, and that's another big capital infusion. The guys who manage the Gulf oil system for us, our local agents there, Saudi Arabia and so on, they're supposed to make sure that the profits go into U.S. Treasury securities, U.S. corporations. Maybe we can't sell General Motors cars in, Europe. Well, the Kuwaitis will buy them, because we got our stranglehold around their necks. So we'll sell them to them, and Bechtel can turn Saudi Arabia into a parking lot or whatever the next task is. And we can sell them $18 billion of arms, as we're doing this year, while talking about how we got to stop proliferation. All of that is using our comparative advantage in world trade and ensuring that those guys who have the money pay for it. So that capital's got to flow back here and secondarily to Britain. So those are, I think that's what comes out of the analysis that you give. And it's the conclusions being drawn. Yeah, these economies, the United States and its British lieutenant have declining economies. They have the force, primarily us. There is a shared interest in stopping those who try to plunder the rich. We'll use the force to do it. If the other rich guys don't like it, we'll make them like it, because we have the guns, and they'll do what we tell them. And then, of course, we want to ensure that we continue to control Gulf oil resources, so we've got that flow of capital, too. And the U.S. population will become Hessians. Actually, this combines with, let me just finally end this by saying there's something internal in the United States that's relevant, too. Everybody knows there's a very serious decline in educational standards and health standards and infrastructure and so on and so forth, and it's generally predicted there's going to be a pretty big shortage of skilled labor over the coming years. A lot of the jobs are going to have to be filled by people from our domestic third world, and they're not going to be trained for it, so we got a problem. That means that the multinationals are going to transfer a lot of functions overseas, maybe ultimately even research, but managerial, product development, that kind of stuff. What happens to the population here? Well, a large part of them you stick in jail, say. Other parts you leave in the inner cities and let them kill each other or something like that. But there's some jobs, too. We always need Hessians, and you don't need too much training for that, You need some, but, not really a lot. You want to go out and slog around the desert or something, or push the buttons or run the bulldozers that push people into holes or something. That doesn't really take tremendous skills. So that's a job. We will have the job of Hessians if all else fails. Well, you know, these aren't inevitable developments, but these are some of the things that follow from the conditions that you outline, and I think those conclusions have been drawn, and I know they have been drawn. You find them in the financial press, and we've even seen them beginning to develop in the last year.
Larry?
You can only get assurances if you have power, and there's no way for the Soviet Union, even if they wanted to, which they don't. Mainly, they want to. They'll do. At this point, though, the Soviet leadership will do just about anything the U.S. tells them to do, and for obvious internal reasons. The withdrawal, there will be no guarantee given to them, or if maybe it'll be asked just pro forma, but it certainly won't be given that the U.S. won't invade. Nor will the U.S. close down the Guantanamo base, which is, after all, the only foreign military base in Cuba and has been all this time. But that's all kind of beside the point, in my view. The important thing wasn't some Soviet troops. You know, the important thing was East Bloc economic assistance. That's the one thing that really broke the U.S. stranglehold. The U.S. has effectively intimidated other countries so they won't break the quarantine. I mean, at the recent Ibero-American conference, you know, Latin American and Spanish leaders, there was a lot of verbal support for Castro, not because they like Castro, they hate him, but just because they were showing independence of the Colossus of the North. So a lot of verbal support, you know, even from people like Endara and Panama, you know, kind of, you know, thanks for standing up and so on. But that doesn't translate into anything. We got a whole, you know, 50 years of history on this. When the U.S. was getting ready to invade Guatemala to overthrow that virus back in 1954, there was a lot of support for Guatemala voiced at the OAS. You know, when the Prime Minister of Guatemala made a speech, defiant speech, saying we're going to defend their rights, everybody applauded, standing ovation and so on. But it didn't translate into defying the terrorist state that runs the hemisphere. That's just too dangerous. So applauding is okay and expressing your sentiments is okay, but we're not going to get in the way of the 800-pound gorilla. And the same is pretty much true of Europe and Japan. It's not, you know, they don't care that much. It's not to their interest to defy U.S. power. The only people who defied it was the East Bloc for their own reasons, and that's gone. So now we can watch Cuba, the stranglehold, take effect, watch Cuban economic decline. It'll lead to an increase in internal unrest, an increase in repression, which is already pretty severe, and, you know, pretty soon it'll be a ripe fruit. We'll be able to go in and liberate them. That's the ideal. You know, it might require some pushing, but that's the ideal. The nearest thing there is to that is the phrase 500-year, the 500-year Reich, which was coined by actually a friend of mine, Hans Dieterich, who's a German social scientist, teaches part-time in Mexico, and that was the title of this book, or would have been the title if the German government had allowed it. That's the closest that I know of, at least. Oh, well, okay. You're supposed to. Oh, she's got the killer instinct, so she's supposed to call.
I have the killer instinct with that, yes, sir.
That's a serious problem. How will the North deal with migration from the South? Well, you know, that's a big problem in both Europe and mainly in Europe. Like countries like Germany, which is an extremely racist country, incidentally, part of the reason why Europe doesn't have some of the problems that we have. Like Europe doesn't have the horrifying slums that the United States has and so on. That's partly because a difference in social policy, but it's partly something else. So Europe had the brilliant idea of exporting its slums. Our slums are internal. Europe's slums are in Turkey and, you know, North Africa and places like that. In other words, they take in the cheap, exploitable labor and they leave the people behind. So they don't have to worry about the families in Turkey of the so-called guest workers, you know what that means, in Germany. We have them all inside, so we got both the slums and the workers, or the non-workers. Well, now, when, you know, the countries of Europe needed the cheap labor, they brought them in, though, you know, you leave the people behind, so you don't have to worry about them. That's becoming tricky. So you go to Germany now, and there's a lot of concern about, say, the Turkish workers. And there's even more concern about what happens when the European community gets established and these guys from southern Portugal or, you know, Greece can theoretically come in freely. In a very racist, homogeneous society like Germany, that's a very tough thing to face. And they don't even like the East Germans to come in because too racist to accept them. And the idea there might be Turks around or something, that's not easy to deal with. Same is true in France, where they're very worried about the North Africans. And this is accelerated by demographic facts. The population's leveling or even declining in Europe, and not only in Northern Europe. Actually, Italy has the lowest birth rate of Europe at the moment, and lower, not even high enough to reproduce the population. And again, on all the standard racist grounds, that's causing, you know, the expectable agitation. So the idea is there's going to be a decline in, you know, nice white folk, and all these ugly black folk are going to be pushing up from down below, and what do we do about it? That raises lots of problems. I mean, the question arises in the United States with regard to Mexican labor. The agricultural, you know, the international corporations want it. It's not just in southern, you know, in the south. My daughter, who's used to work with the United Farm Workers for years, now happens to be teaching in Maine. And she discovered something which nobody knew. She was at a supermarket in the town in Maine where she teaches and heard people talking Spanish, so she was interested. Spanish, and she walked over and started talking to them, and they got scared and walked away, so she recognized the symptoms, illegals. You know, what are illegal Mexicans doing in Maine? Well, it turns out a couple of miles off in the hills there's an egg farm, or whatever you call it, an egg factory or something, that is producing, it turns out, about 80% of the eggs for New England, and it's run like an old 18th century slave plantation. You know, it's imported Mexican workers brought under false pretenses, living in a company town, you know, with the boss running around with a gun, making sure nobody walks on the premises, no protection, you know, no legally, I mean, nothing of that kind. People living in horrendous conditions and so on. Well, you know, that's useful. I mean, it's nice when it's Maquiladora Industries in northern Mexico, but if you can have it here, why not? And this is, I mentioned Maine because that's as far from the you know, the border as you can get. And probably you look around, you find plenty of this stuff. So there's mixed feelings about what to do with this migration. It's cheap, easily exploitable labor. It doesn't have the minimal protections that American citizens have. Very minimal if you're wrong color and poor, but at least something. They're not going to stand up and ask for any rights because they can just be sent back or, you know, sent off into nowhere or whatever. On the other hand, there's the fear of, you know, contaminating the race purity and all that kind of stuff, which is much stronger in Europe than here. And for, you know, so yeah, those are problems. I don't know how they're going to be dealt with, but they're obviously going to be big problems.
Okay.
Right. What's the role of international drug running? Well, the U.S. is up to its neck in international drug traffic. That's not a big secret. In fact, it's very closely followed U.S. intervention since the Second World War. So the fascists, who, whatever you think about Nazism, you know, not very pretty, maybe the worst thing in history, but the fascists did one thing. They run a tight ship, and they wiped out the European drug trade. They don't accept competition, you know. They keep everything under control. So the mafia was essentially wiped out. As the U.S. liberated southern Italy, the mafia was reconstructed. You know, you needed them to run the place and break the bones of union leaders and that kind of stuff. In Europe and France, where it was necessary to break the unions and ensure that we had our type of democracy, you know, with no contamination by the resistance or democratic elements or working class elements and so on. Say in southern France, it was necessary to find people to break strikes and break bones on the waterfront and so on. And there are guys who were good at that, like the Corsican Mafia. So the CIA, as one of its earliest operations, began to enlist the Corsican Mafia to break up the French labor unions. Well, you know, they don't do it just for the fun of it. Maybe they like it, but they got to get a payoff. And the payoff was that they were allowed to reconstruct the heroin trade. And that's the source of the famous French Connection, which became the source of the international heroin racket for a long time. Then it transferred over to the Golden Triangle, you know, Southeast Asia. That was, again, closely associated with CIA subversive activities in Thailand in the 50s and on to the 60s. Switched over to Afghanistan, you know, to Central America, I mean, connect all, you know, the Contra operations were up to, up to the next one. Cocaine and so on, and that's all makes perfect sense. You know, you can exactly expect that. It's not all of it, but it's a large part of it. It makes perfect sense. Clandestine activities need money. They need thugs and so on. And there's an obvious, they secret money. That was the source, you know, drugs. So it tends to follow intervention activities. And it's much more than that. I mean, U.S. social policies also contribute to it. It's like even the things that people are supposed to like, say, food for peace. That's one of the things we're supposed to like, you know. Well, food for peace, one of its, maybe its major aspect, like most social policy, most social policy is welfare for the rich, and so are things like food for peace. So food for peace comes out to be a kind of a subsidy to American agricultural exporters. And that means that cheap U.S.-produced food floods some third-world country and undercuts subsistence agriculture there and leaves lots of people with nothing to do, so a lot of them flock to the cities and to these horrifying slums. But others are good capitalists. They ask, well, what's profitable? And it happens there is a crop that's still profitable if you're, say, a Peruvian or a Bolivian farmer, namely coca. And there are plenty of buyers. So you drive people to producing, you know, producing drugs. And that kind of thing is also a big effect. Well, you know, that's part of the, a big part of the international capitalist system, partly connected with the enforcement operations, just partly connected with the ordinary methods by which any state, including our state, subsidizes and maintains the competitive parts of its system by public subsidy, which means flooding world markets and undercutting local producers and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's going to continue to be a big thing, doubtless. If you go to the Middle East on a much smaller scale, it's a problem right now in southern Lebanon. Part of the reason why the U.S., you read the Hebrew press in Israel, you'll find that part of the reason why Israel doesn't want to withdraw from southern Lebanon, where it's been in violation of Security Council demand to withdraw for 13 years now, 14 years coming on, one of the reasons is that that region is one of, is, you know, not by world standards, but by regional standards, is a pretty big drug producer. The Israelis don't want to hand over the profits from drug production to the Syrians, who are probably going to dominate it. They use that, according to the Israeli press, to pay off their local terrorist army, the SLA, which keeps the thing under control, and even to supplement, you know, soldier salaries and to make sure that the drug flows properly into Egypt and such places. There are very few countries that don't have their hand on this somewhere or other if they have a chance to. The U.S. role is particularly big, but that's, after all, just a reflection of the fact that we're a big actor. You know, other guys are small actors in comparison. So to get back to your point, I think we can expect all of these concomitants of the international drug flow to continue. Well, this is a question that's a point that's, could you hear? Well, she points out more eloquently than I will repeat that maybe, you know, this kind of interchange can lead to more understanding, but if you look around, things seem to be getting more worse all the time. I mean, for unions and for the poor and for the third world and so on. So, you know, it was made personal, where do I get the hope to continue? But it's more general, you know, where do we all get the hope to continue? What makes us keep going? There are several ways of responding to that. For one thing, just first of all, descriptively, it is not clear that it's true. Quite apart from why, I think that's independent of whether you keep going. You know, like if you're watching somebody torture a child and you say, well, it doesn't look like I can help, so why should I try? That's not the right response. You know, you try anyway. So even if your description was correct, it would have no consequences as far as I can see. But I don't even think it's correct. You started by mentioning Cuba. Now, remember the story of Cuba. The plan that I described for overthrowing the regime was from March 1960. That led to an invasion. The invasion failed because of the Soviet deterrent, primarily. You know, it led to the missile crisis, virtually blew up the world, but the Soviet deterrent stopped an invasion. The Kennedy administration then turned to a massive operation of international terrorism. Huge operation. I mean, just dwarfs over anything else in the world, you know. I mean, poisoning stocks and livestock, you know, blowing up hotels, destroying, sinking fishing boats, I mean, sabotage. Actually, one of those operations virtually brought about a world war. I mean, it was one operation, Operation Mon. And so the reason for the missile crisis was that one reason for it was that the operations were building up to a probable invasion, or so it looked, in October 19, 62, which is when the missile crisis took place. It's kind of, from the Soviet and Cuban point of view, they thought it was defensive. That's what it looks like. One of these operators, if you recall the missile crisis, you know, you remember maybe the tensest moment of modern history. You know, one of the tensest moments, the missiles were actually under the effective control of the Cubans. You know, they were the people who actually, Cuban soldiers actually were around the bases. They were, had their fingers on the button. Russia had sold them out from their point of view. Russia had made a deal with Kennedy. Khrushchev had made a deal with Kennedy that he was going to let him go, you know, pull him out. Right at that moment, you know, very tense moment, one of the Kennedy terrorist operations took place. Cuban factory was blown up by one of the Operation Mongoose teams, killing 400 workers, according to the Cubans. Okay, so big terrorist operation. You know, that's not normal, blowing up, I think it was a petrochemical installation, killing 400 workers, right at the moment when the Cubans had their fingers on the button and felt that the Russians were selling them out and not defending them. Well, you know, that's probably brought us closer to nuclear destruction than anything else in history. Nobody cares, you know? I mean, this information was released a couple of years ago in a footnote in a journal of international called International Security, which is a strategic analysis journal. Nobody paid any particular notice to it, never mentioned in the press. Yeah, okay, so we're going to blow the world up with a terrorist operation. That's just a small indication of the scale. And it went right on, you know, it went right on through the 70s. For all we know, it's still going on. You know, we're usually like 10 or 15 years behind and knowing how these things are going, but we can certainly document it through the 70s, blowing up airplanes, I mean, civilian airplanes, all kind of stuff. In addition to that, there was economic strangulation. I mean, Cuba was put under a quarantine. The embargo is flatly illegal, you know, violates every, you know, all of our international commitments, but the U.S. doesn't care about that kind of stuff. Anyhow, without going on, my point is this, there was no protest. You know, there has been the protest against all of this stuff, the international terrorism, anything, the quarantine, the strangulation, is virtually zero. Well, you know, that's, I think things are better than that. That was the early 60s, 70s. Things are better than that now. The U.S. replayed the same game in Nicaragua, but there was plenty of protest. And the protest made a difference. You know, didn't save them from a pretty horrible fate, but it made a difference. Well, that's an improvement. That's a step forward. And I think we find that quite generally. In fact, the Bush administration, or in fact, no administration now, even believes that they can carry out classical intervention. It isn't even an option anymore. I mean, classical intervention means the Marines slogging around, you know, after Sandino for a couple of years, or hundreds of thousands of American troops marauding in South Vietnam for years, that kind of stuff. That's not even considered a policy option. And the reason is because things have gotten better, and they've just gotten better because of domestic, you know, a domestic, an improvement in the cultural level, whatever you call it, you know, a change in the cultural environment, which has made more domestic resistance to depredations. Now, you know, the guys who are running the international class war have plenty of cards up their sleeve, so they got alternatives and they can try other things and so on, but the options are narrower. Well, that's a reason for, that's a sign of success. It's not an indication of failure. Even the Iraq war illustrated that. The options for intervention are extremely narrow. You know, very rapid smashing victory without any combat over an enemy that's first demonized. That's about what the option is now reduced to, very different from before. And on the domestic front, again, you know, it's sort of up and back. There are things that have gotten much better, things that have gotten worse. Yeah, the unions have been very much weakened. I mean, on the other hand, there is, you know, there are kinds of popular organization that didn't exist 20 or 30 years ago. The Central American Solidarity Groups, things like that, really didn't exist during the 60s. 60s protest was very narrow. You know, it was young people, well, mostly students, you know, in some universities, and very late also. Now it's much broader. I mean, the Central American Solidarity movements were very well rooted in the whole society. Furthermore, there are other things, like, say, take, say, the feminist movement, which is the outgrowth of the 60s that probably had the largest general participation in some fashion or other. Okay, that changed things. And there are other developments of that kind. So, you know, you can draw a lot of conclusions from looking at the evolution over the last 30 years. But ultimately, it's not to the point. You know, whatever conclusion you draw from looking at that record, the options that you have before you. I mean, we don't know. We have a very partial understanding of what's going to happen, but we have some understanding. If we decide that things are hopeless, you can be sure that they will be hopeless. If you decide that there's some hope, then maybe they won't be hopeless. Those are the choices.